Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Hello and good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Start, restart there. Just trying to get my day going. Here's a verse out of Zephaniah, chapter 3, verse 17. The Lord your God is with you, the mighty warrior who saves. I love that image. He will take great delight in you. In his love, he will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing. What? What? He's going to sing over me? Uh-oh. We've got a great show today. My first guest is George Fraser, and because we discussed nothing in advance, I have no idea what we'll be talking about. But today's word of the day is saprogenic. Rebecca, any idea what that means?
Oh, that's a new one to me.
Okay, saprogenic. The meaning is causing or produced by decay. It's a Greek etymology. Sapro means rotten. Genetic means producing. So now I have to use it in a sentence. Here we go. Let me try this. The Mugu Gai Pan in my refrigerator from Halloween is getting pretty saprogenic.
That is a very graphic image. Thank you, Phil.
You're welcome. You're welcome. General Hospital just crossed the 14,000th episode mark, and it still has no plot.
Who needs one of those?
I suppose not.
Really?
And after 14,000 episodes of General Hospital, you'd think someone would lock the door so no one could walk in on them doing something nefarious.
Some of us never learn, Bill.
All right. Great show today. George P. Fraser, co-host of Real Recovery, is going to be on in just a minute. And also then Dr. Ken Kaiser will be in, and we'll talk about news of the day. And then Mike Lindell, the creator of MyPillow, is going to be joining us a little after 7. And he is going to be involved in the event Saturday at Pulse here in the Twin Cities at U.S. Bank Stadium. And he is going to be part of the world's, probably going to go in the Guinness World Book of Records as the world's largest pillow fight. I can't wait to find out what that's going to be like, but it's a 50,000 pillow fight. I want in. It sounds like fun. All right. I was on this day that Margaret Hamilton, the witch from The Wizard of Oz, died. She was 82. She got booked for that show, the movie, The Wizard of Oz, like the day before it started. She was looking for work. She was an actress for MGM, and the agent called and said, "Hey, we got a role for you in The Wizard of Oz." And she said, "Which role?" And he said, "The witch." She said, "But of course." And she is the number one female villain in movie history. Pretty good gig. All right. I'm going to take a little break. I'm going to come back. My friend and co-host of Real Recovery, George Initial P. Fraser, will be with me in just a minute. Good morning. We are back. I know one guy who does not function very well in the morning or the afternoon or the evening is my guest, George Fraser, who's actually in studio with me right now. Good morning, George.
Hey, could we do this a little earlier next time, Bill?
We'll try next time a little bit earlier. We've got a great episode of Real Recovery coming up on Saturday and Sunday this week. And we really, George, had a chance to talk about the idea of addictions, compulsive behaviors, but more so about the sinful nature. We talked about Romans 7:8 says, "I know that nothing good lives in me, that is my sinful nature. If I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out." I know sin has taken on a different look in the world today. This is live radio, George.
Okay. Okay. So I know you want me to say something here, so I'm going to.
here's
the deal. We talk about this a lot, that, you know, sin is almost forbidden to even talk about because it's demeaning and it's judgmental. Well, it's true. So we've got to start with the truth. And the Romans, there's nothing good living in me. is step one of the recovery program of the 12 steps. We admit we're powerless over drugs, alcohol, and everything, and our life is unmanageable because we're trying to be God in our life. And that's where everything starts. And you need to have a recognition of that, Bill, that we have a problem. And that comes from an outside agency, the Holy Spirit. So what happens is we realize I have this problem. But where we get short-circuited a lot of times in recovery is we think that the sin is a behavior, a thought, an action, rather than our whole being.
Mm-hmm. So, George, when we talk about sin in today's world, and it's obviously very real to us Christians and followers of Christ, we use it all the time, and we should use it all the time.
Right.
But the world does not like that word as much, and they find alternatives, and sometimes it's masked behind medicalized terms. We're going to talk about this a little bit this morning, but also on the show this weekend on Real Recovery. But the idea that maybe you're not a thief, maybe you're a kleptomaniac. So the fact is that you're not accountable for your behavior because you've got this condition. So we can work on that condition called kleptomania.
Yeah, for me, I'm not sinful. I just make poor choices sometimes.
There you go, yeah.
Like every time I sin, but I'm not capable of making right choices, and I think that's where we have to go to, because if I am, then through education and maybe some therapy, which in my case would still be good,
mm-hmm.
some therapy,
lots of therapy, so I can talk
to myself differently and make better choices that are less harmful to me and to others.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's good, but the problem is I'm still me.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we have the addiction or the kleptomania or, you know, the sexual acts or the gambling or the stealing or whatever is because there's something wrong with us. And I remember the movie Stripes, from which I've put a lot of my life in, when they're in the barracks,
yeah.
And the guy says, there's something seriously wrong with each and every one of us. That is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But with our building up our humanity and the humanistic society we have, we're beautiful creatures. We're just misdirected. That is not the truth. We were born into sin and in a sinful world, and there's only one name that can transform us, and that's Jesus. The
mm-hmm.
rest is harm reduction.
Yeah.
So I think that's what you get when you medicalize everything. I'm not a doctor. You know, the poor choices, the sinful desires can become a disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had lung cancer last year. I used to smoke. People ask me, did you smoke? I smoked a lot of stuff, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I quit in 23 years before it was enough time. It wasn't. But the disease came because of my sinful actions.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're not a theologian, or do you play one on television, but how much of our sin is our choice? I mean, if we are born sinners and we're living in a condition of darkness outside of God's family, how much of sin is our choice?
All of it. And, you know, in my case, my sins are fun. And that's why I don't want to quit. When our guest coming up on Sunday, Jason, talked about doing drugs, he likes doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said if you like doing the bag more than doing the right thing, you're probably going to do some time. And if there's, you don't care about
mm-hmm.
that. Sin is progressive. You know, it's primary, progressive, chronic,
mm-hmm.
and fatal. You need to treat it first. If you don't treat it, it's going to get worse. You're always going to have it. And it leads to death, but sin in our life leads to ultimate death. You don't have eternal life. You go to hell.
Right. George, how much of sin is connected to the pleasure center in our brain?
I think most of it. I think what it gets down to, Bill, and of course I'm just going on what I believe,
mm-hmm.
is that we want to be God. I want to make my own choices. I know better than he does. And when you get into recovery, you finally have to admit, I don't know better than God does. My ways are sinful, and what that is, sin to me is doing my will instead of God's, very
mm-hmm.
simply.
Mm-hmm.
What do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. You know, I'm thinking about just the way we're brought up, and if you are raised in a family where, you know, the parents want to try to give you what you want, and, you know, what would you like to do for your special birthday or whatever, you know, we're trying to find things to do for the kids to make them happy. There's almost a conditioning that, you know, you want your kids to be happy and fulfilled, but how do we instill in them the idea that we need to surrender our life and our will over to the care of God?
Well, that's great. I think we model what our parents do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bring them up young in the Lord, and then they won't go away from it when they get older. I think we need to model that. But who do we serve? Do we serve ourselves, or do we serve God? Choose mm-hmm. today whom you will serve.
Mm-hmm. Have you had conversations? Does it come up in conversations with people in recovery, because you're in the recovery communities? Do you find that you ever use the word sin, or do you have better ways of being on their turf with them, for lack of a better way to express what I'm trying to say?
That's a great question, Bill. Shocking.
Shocking, but this early
in the morning. In the recovery book, sin is mentioned, but more often we talk, recovery people talk about missing the mark, poor behavior choices, you know, the selfishness, self-centeredness, mm-hmm. Dishonesty, and those are all sins, but that word sin, I don't hear it used a lot.
Yeah. I was with my friend Doug Nunke, who is the president of the Navigators, last week. We were having coffee, and he had written a blog, which I found interesting because he's a fly fisherman, and he wrote a blog about called Match the Hatch, which is what a fly fisherman does. He goes out into the stream, and he sees what the fish are feeding on, and he creates out of his tackle box a fly that looks similar to it. So when the fly goes in the water, the fish go, ah, more breakfast, and then they bite on it. And I know this is, you're looking at me like, where are you going with this? But
no, I'm trying to stay awake. Sorry.
Okay. If you're going to match the hatch, so to speak, we have to find ways in which to talk to people that are in a certain sinful environment that we can have conversation with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a really good analogy. And that would come out of the book of James, that we're, you know, taken away and enticed by our own lust. That's the fly fisherman mm-hmm. analogy for me. And I think the guy hits it right on the head there.
Yeah, because sometimes we get stuck talking in Christianese language, and we use all these words that nobody gets.
Bless you, Bill.
Well, thank you. I'll bathe that in prayer. But you know what? Just that we have ways of talking that confuse people, and we separate ourselves, which is not wrong to be living a life distinctively separate from the lost world. But however, we got to live in the lost world, and we need to be able to communicate effectively to people that we want to reach for Christ.
Thank you for unpacking that for me.
And you got that right, George. All right, we'll take a little break. When we come back, more or maybe not more of George Fraser. It all depends on what kind of mood I'm in after the break. Gray skies are gonna clear up. Welcome back to the show.
I survived.
You did survive. And boy, the emails came flooding in. They wanted you to stay, which I found amazing.
Shocking to me, too.
Shocking to me. So anyway, George, I appreciate our conversation we're having. I think it is something, as Christians, we need to have more conversation about meeting people where they're at, finding ways in which we can come alongside people, and maybe just, you know, be involved in an activity that they like. You know, you've probably done some stuff to try to have conversation with people. You know, of course, you play golf, so you do nothing you don't like. But that is a way in which you can reach the lost, because you're doing an activity that other people like doing.
One of the things that I feel God's called me to do, I guess basically the call in my life, is to share the gospel with people that are already in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real burden on my heart that a lot of people that have really made some great changes in their life with God's help don't acknowledge Jesus as the source. And I think when we go back to the beginning of our conversation about sin, in order to realize how bad we are, we need to realize how great and holy He is. And if you don't connect those two, you're not going to get that you're in a sinful state.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the behaviors, it's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's you were created in a fallen world, and you need to be redeemed and transformed. And the only name that can do that is Jesus Christ. And it breaks my heart when I see people that haven't had a drink and they're working with other people and they model what I believe the first century church was, and they have all the good things, but they're missing the best, and that's the salvation that can only come from Christ. So really, the good is the enemy of the best, but the problem is because there's been behavior change and happiness, they give credit to the wrong source, my higher power, the group, the program. here's how I did it. You didn't do it. You didn't even want to do it. You were willing to go to jail so you wouldn't do it. And God transformed you. And we don't acknowledge that. And to me, that breaks my heart. The other part that does is the Christian community that says, those guys don't have Jesus. Well, how about a little compassion there and going, that guy's dying and going to hell. And rather than point your finger at him, go share God with him.
Yeah, there you go. George, you're a little wound up this morning, which I like.
Coffee, Bill.
Yeah. Speaking of wind up, you know, our hearts are like a wind up clock and we don't know how many ticks we have. And one day it stops ticking and then you enter eternity. And George, we had an experience just this last week with a guy that we both know who kind of died unexpectedly.
Yes.
And that was a tough one for me. I love this guy, and he has suffered through many different treatments and has been living a life of addiction for years. Now he's clean and sober, and he wants nothing more to live for Jesus. And he died last week. Young man.
Saved.
Saved.
In heaven.
Saved in heaven.
Death, where is thy sting? It's gone.
Yeah. So I think it's, I love that we always are bringing up the fact that it's great that whatever addiction you're working on getting past, that it's all a deck of cards if you're not saved.
Yeah, you miss the whole point, and the great deceiver will do that, blinding the eyes of people. Hey, you know, I haven't had a drink in 30 years.
As if that's the victory, if that's the outcome. The victory is not sobriety. That's part of the victory. The victory is what we have in Christ.
Yeah, and I need to confess publicly that...
No, we just ran out of time.
Yeah, that...
Because I don't know what you're going to say.
I know. There's a whole gamut we could go down here. The career for Bill could be over.
Yeah.
Get your finger on that button, Rebecca. Here's what it is. I confess that I stood behind my comfort level and didn't share the news of Jesus with recovery people for many years, and that came to an end. I really got convicted a few years ago of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can rationalize that, well, maybe they'll come in with the higher power and they'll find Jesus later. Well, you know what? Most people don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hebrews says faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. So
absolutely.
Let's tell the word of God. Let's tell about John 3:16 and John 3:5, and for God so loved the world, and that unless you are born again, you cannot see the kingdom of heaven.
One of my favorites, and I love all those, is John 3:17, because he came in the world to save it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can miss that Jesus really does love me, but he loves me enough to share the truth with me.
Yeah. And I think, George, your episode with your life-threatening cancer diagnosis, which now your doctors basically said you're cancer-free, which is unbelievable. And
we still have the mental problems. You know, it's kind of like that old Timex commercial.
I was getting to the mental problems.
I beat you to it.
Yeah, you did.
George F. took a licking, but keeps on ticking. Do you remember that
commercial? Oh, yeah, John Cameron Swayze.
Yeah, he couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah, he'd show his little watch on his wrist. And
like an iron.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it keeps on ticking. That's you, my friend. And what a blessing it is. Look at me using that fancy Christian word, a blessing that you are in my life as my friend and co-host of Real Recovery.
I feel the same way. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thanks for getting up.
A lot more people listen to this than listen to ours.
Not necessarily the truth. A lot of people listen to Real Recovery. You know that for a fact.
I do.
Yeah, yeah. But George, thanks for coming in and talking to me this morning, and I will see you soon. And for those of you who... listen to Real Recovery. Thanks for doing so. And if this conversation intrigued you, you might want to tune in Saturdays at 3, Sundays at 5 on the Faith Radio Network, myfaithradio.com, or 90.7 in the Twin Cities here. And, of course, all over the listening network, 89.1 in Bismarck, 94.1 in Hartford, 93.1 in Waterloo, and 104.7 in Madison. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute.
If you're picking up drive-through coffee this morning on your way to work, tell them Bill says hi and make mine a double. The Early Morning Late Show on Faith Radio.
Good morning. It's 29 minutes after the hour. Apparently where you live has a bigger impact on happiness and health than you might imagine. So I was seeing an article listing the 10 happiest places in the country, And I am excited to announce that the happiest place in the country is, drumroll, Minnesota. And there's more to come after the break. We'll take a little break for news, and then we come back. Dr. Kent Kaiser should stroll into the studio any minute. I look forward to his smiling face, and you will hear bagpipes soon.
Listening to Faith Radio, where you can find relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching to help you grow in your faith. Our mission is to lead people to Christ and nurture believers in their faith through Christ-centered media. Find out more about your favorite programs and features and find helpful articles on relevant topics such as marriage and family, finances, health and wellness, and spiritual growth, all at myfaithradio.com.
It's 26 minutes till the top of the hour. You know, the word discipline has a lot of bad rap. I love the word discipline. And I think by default we can be kind of lazy, you know. So discipline's really a good thing. And Dr. Philip Nation, he's a pastor and an author, he said living simply starts with practicing spiritual discipline. He says it all begins by looking at what you love most.
Where's my heart's affection? Where is my mind's attention? Where do I place my affection and my attention? And those are the things I'm going to discipline myself to follow after and chase after. And everything else becomes just this really sad case of idolatry where we're just trying to domesticate deity and just get him conformed to who we are. And that's the problem with legalism. In the end, it's not trying to convince God that we're good enough for him. It really is diminishing God so that he will just bow to our whims and our will. And so we need to first ask the question, where is all of my love placed? What is it that I esteem and I hold in the highest value? And then you let the disciplines chase after.
Do you want to hear that interview in its entirety by Dr. Philip Nation? You go to myfaithradio.com, type in Habits Holiness. It should get you there, pretty sure. All right, next up, the smooth, gentle music of bagpipes. We'll be introducing Dr. Kent Kaiser.
Mom and Dad, what value are you placing on family devotions in your home? This is Jim Garlow in a special series for the family. Deuteronomy 11:19 says, "Teach your children when you sit at home, when you lie down, and when you get up." As a child, our family devotions were in the morning. My dad would read a devotional. And they were hard-hitting and focused on God and what He said in His Word. Then we'd get on our knees for prayer, then off to school. In raising my own children, nighttime was better. I even acted out devotions at time. Our coffee table became Noah's Ark, complete with giraffes and elephants. As they got older, our family devotions changed, but they were always lively with everyone participating. Family devotions can be fun and a creative way to teach your children as God has instructed us to do. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Twenty-three minutes until the top of the hour. You know that music. That's the walk-up music for Dr. Kent Kaiser, Chair of Communications here at the University of Northwestern, who's just in the middle of wrapping up the finals. They got commencement on Saturday. Y'all ready for that, Kent?
Ready.
Oh, cool. All right. Let's talk about the song and dance that seems to be associated with the Trump and Kim Jong-un summit. Now, doesn't this happen all the time that you sort of get close to some sort of agreement, then the bad guy starts making increasing demands?
Oh, sure. And there's all this, you're right, song and dance is a good way to put it. There's always this positioning, and we've been doing the same thing. You know, both sides do it, and I think that there's a lot of incentive for this summit to take place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it will, and you know, what we get out of it is another question. I mean, like, I suppose, like, on the farthest dream end of this summit would be, I suppose, for many people, be the reunification of Korea.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that would be a real dream come true, but I don't think that that's probably going to happen. Denuclearization, maybe, of the Korean Peninsula, but of course, it can't be a one-way street. I mean, that, you know, if you're talking about denuclearization, oftentimes when American politicians talk about that, it's denuclearization of the other side. You know, it's not
right.
Obviously we're not getting rid of our nukes. And in fact, I mean, the question will be, you know, what happens in the rest of the Korean Peninsula and in that region, I'm sure, because there's going to be a nuclear presence from the United States in that region and other countries too, of course. But so I'm sure that that's all going to be part of this positioning, and, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, obviously, there's been more going on with North Korea on the good side lately with freeing those prisoners and those Americans and so on. But you can't really trust a dictator like Kim Jong-un.
Mm. Plus, I'm impressed you can say that word so many times this early in the morning. The word that started with a D.
Yeah, denuclearization.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I'm not going there. I don't have the courage.
The key is not to say nuclear in the middle like many people do.
All right, let's talk about just the deal-making. Now, President Obama, I think he gave up a fair amount to secure that not-so-great Iran deal. And I think President Clinton offered Arafat 98% of what he wanted, and Arafat still said no. Remember how Clinton was kind of stunned
right,
by that?
Right,
just because he wouldn't throw in the elimination of Israel.
Right.
Arafat said no to the deal. So the person in power in every deal seems to be the one that can walk away.
That's true. And, you know, we walked away from the Iran deal now, so we have the power in a sense. And, yeah, you're right. The person who can walk away from the deal is the one who has the power. In the case of the, you know, I think that the president has actually done a pretty good job of not raising the expectations for this summit with North Korea too much.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he had, then, of course, you know, we'd be in the weaker position. He understands that. I mean, and he's always been in the position of being the one to be able to walk away.
Mm-hmm.
You think about over the last year or so since he's been in office, he has walked away from some things, you know. It's like a good example would be when he gave the Democrats basically everything that they wanted on immigration, but he wanted the wall in exchange, and then they said no, and so he's walked away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So he knows how to negotiate.
Yeah, I mean, he's had lots of wins and plenty of losses, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, you learn a lot through that process.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that as a business person, he had, like you say, a lot of losses and
mm-hmm.
and some wins, and so I don't think it phases him. When there's a little bit of a loss, I mean, he just kind of moves on, and he moves on to the next thing. And, he's shown that time and again here in this last year. He's gotten so much done. It's just,
mm-hmm.
he's had a good couple of weeks here, you know, especially, and it's driving the Democrats crazy.
Yeah. And the media has done a pretty good job of smearing him. So,
well, it's very interesting. You know, we had this great thing happen with the movement of our embassy in Israel
uh-huh.
to Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
and how the media narrative was, you know, came across as being like negative because there were these protests that took place in Gaza. Well, I mean, protests are taking place in Gaza all the time. They're always lobbing bombs from Gaza over into Israel.
I know.
I mean, like the people who live in the south part of Israel particularly, they have to be able to be undercover in like 20 seconds or something when the sirens go off. You know, I mean, that's their day-to-day life. And so all of a sudden the media is, you know, focusing on violence in Gaza. Give me a break.
Mm.
You know, and this was a momentous time. And here's my other thing, like with this moving the capital or our embassy to the Israeli capital of Jerusalem, no future president is going to move it back. No future president is going to be like, we ought to move this embassy back to Tel Aviv. Nobody's going to do that.
No.
I mean, here we've been for several presidential administrations been talking about moving this embassy over to Jerusalem. Trump gets it done, and the media is all negative about it. It's been Democrats, Republicans. And by the way, Chuck Schumer, the most liberal, probably, U.S. senator,
mm-hmm.
praised Trump for this move of the embassy to Jerusalem, which tells you something, too, because he's been calling up for it for years as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's just it's very strange, the knee-jerk reaction of the liberal media to just be opposed to everything that Trump does, or to try and give a black eye to anything he does, to try and smear everything, to try and drum up something negative to sort of, I suppose they think it's balancing off their coverage, but they never did any such thing with during the Obama presidency to balance off with negativity mm-hmm. when they said something positive about Obama. But they just can't seem to bring themselves to be positive about Trump. And again, I was pleased to see that a few liberal senators and representatives actually praised Trump, because oftentimes they've been terrible. I mean, on the Democratic side, I mean, they've had a saprogenic spirit.
Whoa, yeah, you listen to the show. Yeah, you know, I am so impressed.
I think that really they've been rotting from within, in a sense, on the Democratic side, because they've actually, and you hear these stories coming out of Washington about how they actually support something that the president supports, but they will not support it publicly, and they will not support it with their vote because they just have to oppose everything that Trump does. Well, that does not set up that party for future success. I mean, they don't have a proactive agenda, and it's going to be to their detriment. People are talking about how the Republicans are going to do really poorly this fall. I don't believe it. I think the Republicans would be just fine this fall, and I think there's going to be a second Republican wave here this fall or something like that, but I don't think there's going to be any kind of big Democratic wave, because they haven't offered up anything, and the president's having a lot of success. The Republicans are having a lot of success.
Yeah. Okay, Kent, in the spirit of nonpartisan discussion here, how many presidents do we go back that said they would that they want to move the embassy to Jerusalem?
Well, it's at least back to Clinton.
So Clinton,
Bush, Obama.
Okay, did they say they wanted to do it, or did they promise in a campaign that they would do it?
They always promised in a campaign that they would do it, of course. And then they quickly squished, I guess you would say, once they became president. Mm-hmm. And it's mind-boggling to think that, you know, that the media would allow that. I mean, this is the thing that kills me, is like the media knows that these past presidents called for moving our embassy and referring to the capital of Israel as Jerusalem. And yet they don't even bring that up. And here you have this rare thing. I mean, what I think many Americans, normal American voters would say is this rare thing of a president keeping a campaign promise. But, I mean, again, Trump's been keeping campaign promises like crazy. I think it's driving, you know, the Washington establishment kind of nuts, because they're not accustomed to somebody who comes in with an agenda and actually keeps their promises.
Yeah,
they think, everybody just makes these promises during their campaigns, and then they throw them out once they get in the office. But President Trump's actually been keeping them. It's incredible, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just an amazing list of things when you look at, like, he got rid of the individual mandate for Obamacare, which basically guts the thing, which basically guts Obamacare. He kept his promise on Jerusalem. He's kept his promise on ISIS. He's kept his promise on all kinds of foreign policy initiatives. You know, he kept his promise with the Supreme Court pick. And, I mean, you can just go right on down the list, tax cuts. I mean, it's just one thing after the other, and we've seen this rollback. By the way, you know, he talked about rolling back regulations. Like, what did he say? Roll back three for every one, that new one? He's rolled back 16. 16. They've gotten rid of 16 regulations for every new one that's been put in place.
I heard 22.
I heard
22.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And you think about now that how he's sort of greased the skids for American business, and you look at the unemployment rate, and the unemployment rate for Hispanics is lower than it's ever been since the 1990s, I think, or if longer, and for blacks ever in history, and for women, and so on and so forth. And, I mean, you know, the liberals don't want to say, oh, he's some kind of a racist. Well, if he's some kind of a racist, he is doing a really, really poor job of it.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kent, let me take a break. When I return, more with Dr. Kent Kaiser in 13 minutes. We're at the top of the hour. Be right back. Thanks for being with me this morning. It's 10 minutes till the top of the hour, so if you have to get to work, get moving. In the meantime, join the conversation that we're having with Dr. Kent Kaiser. Kent, now you would think that people who are really committed to the climate change, they're advocates that this is what it is, they would be the most eco-friendly of all. Are they?
Well, they're not. According to an academic study, and it's a really rigorous academic study, the people who are climate skeptics are actually the most eco-friendly. And this was a study that was done with 600 people. That's a large sample. And it showed that the people who are the most committed to the idea of climate change and so on are the least eco-friendly. So those who there's two categories of climate skeptic, of course. There's those who just don't believe it's taking place, and then there's those who are not really very sure, but they're kind of skeptical of it. And then, of course, you have that third category of people who are really committed to that idea of climate change and how we need to do something about it. But unfortunately, those people who believe that we need to do something about it don't actually do anything about it as compared with the other people. And I think that there's something to this. There's something bigger to it that they didn't really get into in the study. But, you know, listeners probably remember a few years ago there was a study out that showed that the most conservative people are also the most charitable,
mm-hmm.
and they're more likely to give. And I think there's something to this. I mean, and I think that the people who are least likely to – well, I think that the people who are probably the most committed to wanting to do something, or they say they want to do something about climate change, are probably the most committed to the government actually doing something about it and not about themselves doing something about it. And anybody who's sort of committed to big government, I mean, that becomes their sort of higher power in a way. And for those of us who have a different higher power, we know that we're called to be the ones to do things. And so I think those of us who are called to do things are the more likely to be charitable, more likely to clean up the highway or, mm-hmm. Be committed to the environment and so on. And I think that's what's kind of going on here. But the study didn't really get into all of that. But I do appreciate the study because it's concrete evidence, numerical, statistical, and it shows that, this is the thing. You often see the kind of liberal elites who are so committed to the idea of government solutions to things like climate change are the most likely to kind of look down their noses at the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have us being able to look back at them and, say, look, we're doing more for the environment than you are,
mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with that. That's why it's the same thing with that idea of giving to charity and volunteering and so on. It tends to be the people on the conservative end of the political spectrum who do more volunteer hours, give more money to charity,
mm-hmm.
and now, as it turns out, contribute to the cleaning up of the environment and are more eco-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that funny?
It is. So when you start to hear some of these comments made by alarmists, and I think that's a good word for them,
right.
when they say things like London, Boston, New York will all be underwater, and by 2024, the oceans could be boiling. I go, really? Boiling?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing. And the reason that so many people, I think, are skeptical is that many can remember back to, say, like the 1970s when the big threat supposedly was going to be global cooling. And the thing is, there's a lot of skepticism about whether humans are the ones who are actually creating the problem, and maybe they are contributing, but can't we adapt? I mean, that's part of it too. It's like, why would we commit a ton of resources to mitigating this problem that we can adapt to? We always have adapted, and that's I think the view of many skeptics. It's like we have limited resources to be able to do things.
Mm-hmm.
We could do a lot of good with the money and resources that might otherwise be channeled into what it seems to be maybe a futile effort to mitigate whatever little difference that humans are making in climate change. Climate's changed over many, many, years, and, we can see it. We can actually see it in history where there was like a little ice age back in like the medieval
yeah.
times, and we can see these climate changes over time, and they happen naturally. Well, I mean, if you think about some of the warming periods in history, they used to have agriculture in Greenland, when Greenland was settled, they actually had farms. And you can see through the archaeological record how the people became smaller and smaller and malnourished and so on. And it was because of the climate change at that time,
mm.
And so we know that climate has changed naturally well before there was any impact from human.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's why a lot of people are skeptical and don't really think that a big government solution is the way to go. And so a lot of people, I mean, I'm like that. I mean, I have my little piece of the highway. I go and clean up with my niece every couple times a year.
Nice.
I mean, it's just a little thing.
Yeah, but still.
But I mean, like, you know, it is interesting to see that it's people, conservative like me, who are probably more likely to be doing that kind of thing than those who claim to be so concerned about the environment.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kent, I'm an avid indoorsman. with the exception of today, I'm going to a baseball game at noon. I'm going to sit outside for several hours.
But a nice clean bench, not the ground, though, right?
Oh, for sure, a nice clean bench. Preferably a padded seat. Yeah. I don't know how good the tickets are. But when you talk about living the impact of your happiness and health depends on where you live. Now, you love the outdoors, and you're getting ready to take your first trip up north in the Boundary Waters. And do you think that living in Minnesota has a big impact on your happiness and health?
Well, I think in the summertime I'm happier about it than I am in the wintertime.
Yeah,
I mean, I think like you That's... know it's very interesting. You know, like we're one of like three states with the highest rate of depression. You know, us and Colorado and Maine, I think, are the ones with the highest rates of of depression. You think about the winters in Maine and Minnesota, and I don't know why Colorado. I would think that would be a nice place to be. But
I would
whatever.
Think so, too. Pretty mountains. Yeah. Yeah, nice sunsets.
But, you know, I think that it depends on the time of the year, obviously. But, yeah sure.
Yeah. Kent, thanks so much for being with me in the studio today, and good luck on graduation, getting in your cap and gown. You have to just direct students to
once. We're just ornaments that day.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. Well, you'll make a good-looking ornament. It's 3 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and wrap up hour one. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.